first reading tonight is from Job chapter 2. It starts at verse 11, and that can be found on page 510. To 11 to the end of chapter 3. When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard all about the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him, because they saw how great his suffering was. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, "May the day of my birth perish, and the night it was said, 'A boy is born.' That day, may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it. May darkness and deep shadow claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm its light. That night, may thick darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year, nor be entered in any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shout of joy be heard in it. May those who curse days curse that day, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. May its morning stars become dark. May it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of dawn. For it did not shut the doors of the womb on me to hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why were there knees to receive me and breasts that I might be nursed? For now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep and at rest with kings and counsellors of the earth, who built for themselves places now lying in ruins, with rulers who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child, like an infant who never saw the light of day? There the wicked cease from turmoil, and there the weary are at rest. Captives also enjoy their ease. They no longer hear the slave driver's shout. The small and the great are there, and the slave is freed from his master. Why is light given to those in misery, and life to the bitter of soul, to those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than for hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For sighing comes to me instead of food. My groans pour out like water. What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil." And the second reading is from Mark 15. Which is on page 1023. Mark 15, chapter 15, verse 33. "At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani,' which means, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?' When some of those standing near heard this, they said, 'Listen, he's calling Elijah.' One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. 'Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down,' he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last."
Do turn back to Job. That's probably the best place to be. page 510. Inside your service sheet, you should have found a yellow piece of paper, which has got, it's a handout, it's got an outline of where we're going this evening on one side, and on the other I've put again this week, an outline of the whole of the book of Job. It's a long book, we're going to be dipping in and out over the next few weeks, and one brilliant thing to do would be to read it back at home, maybe more than once, if you could do that, just to get as familiar as possible, and kind of feel Job for yourself. But we need God's help, don't we, as we look at this. So let's just pray together. Lord God, Job did our heads in a bit last week. There's loads of stuff in that first chapter and a half that came as a big surprise. And from Job 3, it looks as if the same is going to be true tonight. Please help us, Lord, to hear what you're saying, to realise what we're going on here and what that means for us and for others around us, and especially for those of us who are going through hard times and those of us who know those who are. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, I've got to say, if you come to church to get a little boost of joy to get you through the next 7 days, and the chances are you might feel a little bit let down this evening. Because we've headed into the depths tonight. Because that's where Job 3 takes us. We learned about Job last week. We saw that he was a good man. Not a perfect man. He admits that himself. But a very good man. And life was going really well for him. And then one day God and Satan had this conversation together in heaven. Look at Job, God said. See how good he is. I'm paraphrasing this a bit, but I think this is the gist of it. Yeah, right, God, Satan replied. Job is only good because you've made his life so easy. Take away the things that he enjoys and he'll curse you to his face, to your face. Okay, God said. You do it. Go for it. And not once, but twice God says that. It comes as such a shock to us, doesn't it? But that's what happens. So twice Satan hits Job really hard. The first time he loses all his wealth and all his children. They get killed. The second time he loses his health, leaving him, chapter 2, verse 8. You can see it there, such a sorry sight. Sitting all alone in the ash heap, scratching his sores. Now, if you've ever been through grief or you've known someone who's gone through grief, you'll know it takes ages to get through. And there's this awful pressure on us, isn't there, to put on a brave face and look like we've got it all together again after a bit. But deep inside, it can go on and on with our thoughts and our emotions just swirling all over the place, which is a bit like the book of Job. And partly the reason why the book of Job is like it is, we're going to see more about that next week. The whole structure of the book of Job kind of reflects the process of grief. But it is in the early days that things are normally bleakest, when we're at our most raw. And that's where we find Job tonight. I wonder what you made of some of the things that Job says in chapter 3. I help out on these Christian camps. I've been doing it for a number of years now. And for a few years, I worked particularly with some of the students who'd come along to get some teaching of their own and do loads of the practical tasks around the site. And one year we had this guy on the team his gran had just died. I mean, he'd pretty much come straight to camp from the funeral. And it hadn't been an ordinary grandson-grandmother relationship. For one reason or another, his gran had basically been his mum. So he was devastated to have lost her. But he had this idea that because he was a Christian, it shouldn't feel too bad. He had all this grief, but he was trying to suppress it and stop it coming out because he thought it was somehow wrong to feel that way if he was trusting Jesus. And there's a fairly well-known Christian song that we don't sing here, that includes the line, "And in his presence, our troubles disappear. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever I've had to sing that song or ones like it, my problems don't disappear at all. They become more vivid than they've ever done. You can almost see them standing waving at you as you're singing. But it is surprisingly easy, isn't it, to be drawn into thinking that actually trusting Jesus should mean that somehow our problems kind of fade away. Now, the mature Christian thing, we think, is to sail serenely on through them all. Surely we might think there is a depth of despair into which no true Christian will ever have to go. Is that right? Is there a depth of despair into which no true Christian will ever go? Do you see how important the question that is? Because what if one day something happens to you or me and we do find ourselves beginning to feel that low? We begin to find ourselves saying things we never thought we'd say. Does that mean that we've somehow lost our faith? Does it mean that somehow Jesus has lost hold of us? Or maybe even that he never had hold of us in the first place? Job 3. Are these the words of someone who's lost his faith? Or what about Psalm 88, the one that we read earlier? I wonder whether you felt really awkward reading some of that stuff. Chances are we did. Imagine someone put Psalm 88 to some singable music and suggested that we sang it here in church. We'd want to say no, wouldn't we? Christians don't say that kind of thing. They don't sing that kind of thing. And then we think, it's a psalm. And they're the songs that God has given his people to sing. Which must mean God knows there'll be times when we feel so low. Psalm 88 is about all we can say. And then think about Job. Think about what we saw about him last week if you were here. He is a man of faith, isn't he? We've seen those two extraordinary professions of trust in God, even when everything had gone wrong. So chapter 1, verse 21. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. That one is so good, we still say it at funerals today. Chapter 2, verse 6. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Sorry, chapter 2, verse 10. And we saw last week, didn't we, that God himself commended Job for his faith in chapters 1 and 2. And we're going to see in a 3 or 4 weeks' time that God himself commends Job at the end of the book. And yet along the way, Job goes through chapter 3. So this is not giving us a picture of a man who's lost his faith. This is a picture, a portrait of authentic Christian grief. But do notice how bleak that can be. So first, notice just how lonely Job is. His wife turns up, chapter 2, verse 9. She's going to comfort him, isn't she? That's what husbands and wives are for. Notice what happens, they have a row. And as far as we can tell, she disappears for a while. And then these three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad and Zophar, they turn up. And we're going to get to know them even better next week. But they put on this united display of sympathy, don't they, at the end of chapter 2. They come to Job, they weep with him. They sit in silence with him for a whole week. And the usual thing is to say that these three friends, they do pretty well at this point. This is the kind of thing that friends should do. And certainly it is pretty good compared to what they do when they begin to talk to Job, when, as we're going to see next week, they're worse than useless. And I guess most of us, we'd love the idea, wouldn't we, of having three friends who would just drop everything and come and be with us at a time like this. But notice how, even though they're there, Job is still really alone, isn't he? It's not the four of them facing this together. It's Job with three friends sitting by. And the things that they do in verse 12, weeping aloud, tearing their robes, sprinkling dust on their heads, the really strange thing is they're not just expressions of sympathy. They're the kinds of things that you did back in the Old Testament for a corpse. when someone had died. These three friends, they're acting as if Job has died. As if he's gone somewhere that they can't go. Because in a way he has. Christopher Ashe, who's written a brilliant little book on Job, and I put the details at the bottom of the outline of the book on the handout, points out how when you suffer, no one else really knows what you're going through, do they? So think about it, exactly the same illness can affect two people in very different ways. Losing your wealth can affect two people in very different ways. And so can losing a person you love. My granddad died earlier this year. I was one of 12 grandchildren. But we all related to him in slightly different ways. And none of them had the same relationship with granddad as I did. Mine wasn't the same as any of theirs. So we all experienced losing him in slightly different ways. We were all there, lined up at the funeral, pretty much sitting next to each other in the pews, all 12 of us, most of us crying. But all grieving in slightly different ways. And I think that's why Job's friends are silent, verse 13, for 7 days. Not necessarily because that's what Job needs. Grieving people, they often do want to hear people's voices, just not always talking to them. The reason these guys are silent is because they just don't know what to say. And we know what that's like, don't we? When someone we know suddenly gets hit by suffering, there's that real awkwardness, isn't there? What do we say? How can our words possibly help? What if we put our foot in it? And it can seem far easier sometimes, can't it, just to talk about something else, pretend that thing hasn't happened, or maybe even avoid them altogether for a bit. And if we're the ones who are going through it, we can know, can't we? That's how people around us are feeling. And so on top of everything else that we're going through, as if that isn't enough, we start feeling really embarrassed and awkward about making them feel that way, so we can retreat and keep ourselves to ourselves. And before we know it, we're even more alone than we were. Grief is a very lonely thing. And it can feel so hopeless as well. And we really feel the force of that in what Job says in chapter 3. I wonder whether you noticed as we read it, the one place that Job never looks in chapter 3. He never looks forwards. The only way he can see is back. And he longs to change what he sees as he looks back. He wants to undo it, in fact. Verse 3 of chapter 3, "May the day of my birth perish, and the night that said, 'A boy is conceived.'" So think about it. Those two moments that mark the beginning of Job, the night he was conceived, the day he was born, he wants to cut them out of the calendar forever. That day, verse 4, "May it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine on it. May gloom and utter darkness claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm it." That night, verse 6, "May thick darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year, nor be entered in any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shout of joy be heard in it." Genesis chapter 1 tells the story of creation, how God took darkness and chaos and made the world out of it. And it's like Job is saying, please, when it comes to the creation of the night I was conceived and the day I was born, can we just rewind it? Undo it. Go back to the darkness. And conception and birth, they're such joyful moments, aren't they, normally? And so we hear that Keith and Claire are expecting. It lifts us all. It's fantastic. Someone brings their brand new baby along to Sundays at 7 for us all to see. And it's just brilliant. And yet Job is in such despair that he wishes he could just delete those 2 days, as far as he's concerned. Surely, he says, it would have been better, verse 11, if I died at birth. Or verse 16, if I'd been miscarried. Or verse 20 onwards, at least if I could just die now. And some of us will know the pain of those things, of losing a child at birth or a miscarriage or having people we love snatched away. But any of those things, Job says, would be better than having to go through what I'm going through right now. Because at least he thinks, verse 13, death would mean peace and sleep and rest. Now we know, don't we, in our clearer moments, that for the Christian there is always hope in the future. Now, we said some of it earlier, didn't we, in the Creed. When we said the Creed, we believe in the resurrection of the body and the life everlasting. And we know that Job knows about those things, because we're going to see later on he talks about them too. But Job 3 is showing us that there can be times in a Christian's life where the future just looks blank. And the misery that we're going through means death really does seem like the only escape. It's striking, isn't it? Worth noticing, though, that even though Job longs for death, he doesn't try and do it himself. That is worth noticing. The statistics say there'll be a number of us here who have thought about suicide or will think about suicide at some point in the future. And it definitely isn't an unforgivable sin. But it's not a right way out. Trouble. How extraordinary. I've got competition. We'll just keep going. Notice the third thing about Job's grief, which is this, that even in the lowest, bleakest moments of all, he can't get away from God. And I don't mean by that he's feeling comfort from God right now. Christians do sometimes talk, don't they, about how when they go through hard times, they can physically sense God's presence with them. It's almost like they can feel his arms around them, kind of carrying them through. Just trust him, they say, and you'll feel that too. Well, Job trusts God, we know that. And he doesn't appear to be feeling that at all. And nor does the person who wrote Psalm 88. Most of the other psalms, I think all the other psalms in the Bible that begin bleakly, at least they end well, because it's like the person who writes it sort of wrestles their way through, thinks their way through to some kind of confidence and joy. Psalm 88 doesn't do that. And in a way, that's a relief, isn't it, for some of us? In a funny kind of way, because... well, it's a relief for those of us who do go through hard times and just, it doesn't feel like God is there comforting us. Because it shows us, Job 3 and Psalm 88, that sometimes that just is what it's like. Whatever our really well-meaning friends may say. We talked last week about C.S. Lewis and his experience of losing his wife to cancer. And one of the things that he decided to do in the days after she died was to write down what he was going through. He found these blank notebooks lying around his house and got writing. And they've been put together in a little book called The Grief Observed. It's well worth reading. And here's one of the very earliest things he wrote in the very early days after his wife had died. "Where is God?" he wrote. "This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you're happy, so happy that you've no sense of needing him, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain. And what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become." Job feels that silence here, but he knows, I wonder if you notice, he can't get away from God completely. Chapter 3, verse 23. "Why," he asks, Is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? And back in chapter 1, Satan suggested that the reason Job lived such a good life was because God had hedged him in with a kind of protective barrier so that nothing bad happened to him. Well, now Job is suggesting God's hedged him in not to protect him, but to imprison him in this misery that he's going through. But even in his blackness, he can't get away from God. And again, I'm not sure that's much of a comfort to Job at this point. C.S. Lewis, again, wrote this: "Not that I am, I think, in much danger of ceasing to believe in God. The real danger is coming to believe such dreadful things of him. The conclusion I dread is not, so there's no God after all, but, so this is what God's really like." You see, knowing that God is there, and as we saw last week, is responsible in some way for what we're going through, can actually just make the pain seem even more bewildering, can't it? But Job can't get away from him. So there we are. A portrait of authentic Christian grief. Do notice, it is Christian grief. Job is a man of faith. But it's very dark indeed. And to be honest, if all we do this evening is begin to get our heads around the fact that this is how it can sometimes feel for God's people, then our time together has been worth it, I think. But as we finish, it's worth just asking, isn't it? Is there really nothing we can say to someone who's in a place like this? Or are we like Job's friends and doomed to sit there in silence? I was chatting a few weeks ago to someone whose dad has fallen really badly ill. And I was doing the things that we do at times like that. I was promising I'd pray and offering to help in any way I could. And he said this: "The trouble is, David, there's nothing anyone can really do. No one knows what it's like. Just have to get through these things on your own." In a way, that's right, isn't it? It's the loneliness of grief. We can't really identify with others in their suffering, but we can point them to someone who can. And even if our lives so far have been basically trouble-free, so really we've got no idea what they're going through, we can point them to someone who does know what it's like. Another man who was completely innocent and yet suffered dreadfully in ways he didn't deserve. Who went through agony, Mark 14, as he looked ahead to his death, with three friends of his nearby. Friends who weren't just silent though, but were fast asleep because they had no idea what he was going through. Someone who, Mark 15, was plunged into real darkness. And he cried out the most despairing words in the whole Bible as he died: my God, why have you forsaken me?" There was more going on at the cross than that. But at the most basic level, it does remind us, doesn't it, that there is someone who knows, and who therefore can meet us in the depths of despair, because Jesus has been there too. We're going to have a few minutes just to be quiet together now. And maybe we want to pray over some of the things that we've heard. Maybe we want to pray particularly for people we know who are going through hard times. It might be you. It might be people you know. And then in a few minutes' time, Claire is going to come and lead us in our prayers. So let's be quiet together now.